This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology, an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Atlassian's Ops Genie. Incidents happen. Thankfully, Ops Genie empowers dev and ops teams to plan for service disruptions and stay in control during incidents. It also gives teams the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues and helps to notify all the right people through a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths. With Ops Genie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. Visit OpsGenie.com to sign up to get a free company account and to add up to 5 team members. That's OpsGenie.com, OpsGenie.com. Never miss a critical alert again with Ops Genie. Welcome to the Science Podcast for December 21st, 2018. I'm Sarah Crespi. This is the last podcast of the year, and we're going to celebrate with a roundup of the top online news stories, according to David Grimm, and we'll hear from news editor Tim Appenzeller. He talks with Megan Cantwell about this year's breakthrough of the year and some of the runners up and breakdowns. And finally, we'll have a look back at the year in books with Jen Golbeck, our books host, and science books editor Valerie Thompson. First up today, we have David Grimm, the online news editor for Science. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Sarah.
So you're bringing us some of the top 10 online news stories for the year.
That's right. We have a top 10 list, but unlike other science news top 10 lists, you know, we tend not to focus on the most important science of the year. We sort of leave that for our breakthrough of the year issue. We sort of focus on our favorite stories of the year.
Yeah.
And that's our sort of a mix of our personal favorites as staff, but also the stories that did very well traffic or wise. So the stories that were
the audience favorites.
Audience favorites, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So what was your favorite? You had a big hand in picking these. What's your favorite story of the year?
Well, you know, I think it was probably this one. It's a really fun story. It's about the longest straight line journey on Earth. And so it's actually a water journey. So the question is, if you had a boat and say you didn't have a steering wheel on your boat and you wanted to be on your boat for a very long time, what is the path that you could take that would put you on the longest straight journey on Earth, that you would never have to turn the wheel, that you could just keep on going in a straight line, but felt like forever?
And this is a question that originated on Reddit. And then who figured out the answer?
Well, that's the other fun thing about this story. This is not a very traditional study for us. There wasn't like, you know, a bunch of scientists coming up with a research project and getting funding. And then it took years and years and years. This actually started as a Reddit post a few years ago. Somebody had seen a post on Wikipedia about what might be the longest straight line on Earth. So he decided to post what he thought it was. And then a couple of scientists saw the post and they said, well, we can go ahead and try to prove this. We can use geometry and all these very complicated, high detailed maps of Earth. And that's what they went ahead and they did. And they found this path that basically goes from southern Pakistan to northern Russia that would yield a trip of about 32,000 kilometers.
Time to get in your sailboat, Dave.
That's right.
So now let's talk about one that had good numbers. So a story that performed really well. And I mean, for good reason, it's also a really interesting story. I'm talking about the pelvis story.
That's right. So this was one of our most popular stories of the year, and it has to do with something called the obstetrical dilemma. And this is this sort of long-held evolutionary theory that the woman's pelvis has to be kind of this, it's a kind of a tug of war between two evolutionary forces. It can't be too wide, which would make childbirth very easy, but it would make walking very difficult.
Oh.
And obviously, it can't be too narrow for sort of the opposite reasons. So, because of that, researchers have sort of long assumed that all pelvis shapes around the world must be pretty similar because they have to kind of deal with the same
Forces.
forces, right?
Yeah.
And that's not what they found. In fact, they kind of found the opposite. These researchers looked at 348 female pelvises from around the world, from 24 different parts of the world. And what they found was that these birth canals were far from carbon copies of each other. There was a lot of variation, and certain regions tend to have certain shapes that other regions didn't.
Huh.
And so that really says that it must not be evolutionary forces that are sort of shaping these
Or
pelvises.
the ones that we thought.
Are the ones that we thought it must be some other factors that are playing a role.
So what that means we're going back to the drawing board, understanding pelvis
It
evolution.
does, but it also sort of has some interesting implications for childbirth because when we're trying to figure out how the baby moves through
Right.
the birth canal, things like that, it may actually inform practices around childbirth. So it's not just kind of an interesting story there. It may actually be some real-world applications as well.
Okay. Now let's talk about, I don't know that this is my favorite, but I just watching this story come together was so interesting. This is the first video of living anglerfish mating. What does it look like, Dave?
Right, anglerfish are these really, really weird fish. They're really creepy. They live really deep in the ocean, and scientists know almost nothing about them. And that's because it's really hard to get much less, not even a video, but even a photograph of these guys when they're alive. If you bring them up to the surface, they can't deal with the change of pressure, and it's kind of a disaster. And so, what's really cool about this is an exclusive that we had, and we always love exclusives. This is the first video taken of anglerfish mating, and it's just sort of as bizarre as the fish themselves. The scientists sort of captured this large female, and she's got this much smaller male, they call her a dwarf male, that's literally attached to her, kind of permanently attached to her body. And he sort of functions as this sperm sac, essentially. So what happens, what they think when anglerfish mate, is the male attaches to the female and actually becomes part of the female. He sort of grows into her and almost
Right.
becomes like a part of her body.
So she's supplying him with
Right.
nutrients. She's eating food. He can't eat food anymore.
Can't do anything,
But he
basically.
does supply sperm
Right.
that she can then lay fertile eggs.
Right. And then there's this amazing video that researchers captured with this deep sea submersible that showed all this. And it became, was it our most
Oh,
popular, but
absolutely.
by far our most popular video of the year. And if you take a look at it, it's not hard to see why
And the
it's
quality
really.
really, I mean, it's well lit. A lot of people say that it looks like it's CGI in the
Oh, really?
movies because it's just so crystal clear, which is very unexpected. Most of the anglerfish photos or anglerfish corpses
Yeah.
that you see are
Right.
pretty tattered and bad
Right.
shape. So this is just really amazing.
Yes.
Let's finish out the ones that we're going to talk about. We're not going to list them all out here today. This one is about tiny quantum engines. Why did this make the cut?
Well, you know, I feel like every year we've got a quantum physics story
Yeah.
on our list because, first of all, we do a lot of quantum physics stories that others don't. So these tend to be kind of exclusives for us, which I just said we like a lot.
Yeah.
But they're also just, you know, the quantum realm is such a bizarre realm. And this is another example of it. This is this really weird property of quantum physics that when you try to measure something at the quantum level, you actually change it. You change its position, its distribution. And in this new study, researchers found that they could actually harness this change to create energy or to create an engine that would operate with near 100%
Okay,
efficiency.
how big is this engine?
And I should back up and say they actually didn't
Okay.
create this. They
They
actually theoretically created it. They said it's theoretically
modeled
possible.
it,
And
okay.
these are engines are very, very small. This would be like the engine the size of an atom or a molecule.
Oh,
So it's
okay.
not something you would necessarily put in your car. But this efficiency is amazing, even though it's sort of theoretical. When you think of a car, the engine's about 25% efficient.
Right.
So if you've got something that's 100% efficient, you can imagine that, you know, you could create these really maybe swarm of tiny, tiny molecular machines. Now, the big question is, what would you use them for?
Right.
And really, how hard would it be to create these things in real life? But just the science around this, the physics around this, it's really, really fascinating to dig into to figure out like how something like this would even be possible in the first place.
Okay, Dave, and as I mentioned, we're not going to reveal the rest of the top 10, so please go to the site. News.
Including our most popular story of the year.
Including the most popular. But one thing that struck me looking at this list is what is not there, and that is a cat story or a dog story, which is just shocking. So, you know, we had a pretty popular story on Viking cats. Why didn't that make the cut?
Yeah, and just like we have a quantum physics story every year, I feel like we've got a cat or a dog story every year, just because I personally love those stories. Also, the stories tend to do very well. So we had last week, we had a story about Viking cats. And this was another exclusive for us. This is a story about how cats seem to have changed size, gotten bigger during the Viking era. And this was an analysis of a bunch of cat bones that were found. Some of these cats were sort of skinned for their fur. So there's a lot of interesting history here too. The story actually ended up being a lot of fun. It became very popular, but all that was sort of happening while we were putting together top 10 lists. So it didn't quite squeak in there, but it's a story that was a lot of fun and I highly encourage listeners to go check it
out. And I'm going to expect at least one cat or dog story next year in the top 10.
I hope so. Okay. I hope so.
All right. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thanks, sir.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. Read the rest of the top online news stories at news.sciencemag.org. Stay tuned for Megan Cantwell's interview with news editor Tim Appenzeller on this year's Breakthrough of the Year. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Atlassian's OpsGenie. Incidents happen, and they require complex coordination between operations and software development teams who are putting out fires every day. That's why getting alerts immediately is critical. Thankfully, there's OpsGenie by Atlassian. OpsGenie empowers dev and ops teams to plan for service disruptions and stay in control during incidents. It also gives teams the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues, and helps to notify all the right people through a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths that account for things like time zones, holidays. Better yet, OpsGenie allows for deep flexibility in how, when, and where alerts are deployed. With over 200 integrations like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. Plus, it tracks all activity and provides useful insights to improve future incident responses. With OpsGenie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. Visit OpsGenie.com to sign up to get a free company account and add up to 5 team members. That's OpsGenie.com, OpsGenie.com. Never miss a critical alert again with OpsGenie.
Several months ago, Science compiled an extensive list of significant discoveries and advancements that have occurred throughout 2018. Ultimately, that list was whittled down to a shortlist of 9 runners-up and 1 winner, the Breakthrough of the Year. I'm here with news editor of Science, Tim Appenzeller, to talk through a few of these advancements. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Megan.
So let's get started with one of the runners-up, which was that the first RNA interference, or RNAi drug, entered the market this year. How exactly does this drug treat diseases?
What it does is it blocks the genetic message from the gene to the cell's protein-making machinery. So it actually gets right at the root of the disease process.
RNAi was discovered 20 years ago, but it took a while for it to reach the market.
Well, it works through small RNAs that trigger the breakdown of this message that I mentioned. And the problem was getting those small RNAs to the right spot in the body.
So in the future, we could probably see other diseases that it's marketed for as well.
I think we'll see more drugs following the same approach, yes.
Another one on the list was gains for the Me Too movement within the sciences and what changes were catalyzed within science organizations and research institutions as a result of this movement.
Well, several big science organizations began developing or at least talking about mechanisms to take away honors from people who have been found guilty of sexual harassment. So this is the kind of thing that the Me Too movement has been pushing for some time. Now it appears to be starting to happen.
One of my personal favorites was the discovery of a 31-kilometer-wide impact crater under Greenland, but they're not sure exactly when it hit. It could have a range of anywhere between 12,000 to 100,000 years ago. When it hit, what would have been the implications for the climate and life on Earth at that moment?
Well, it would have melted an awful lot of ice. And if this had happened at a key moment about 13,000 years ago, it could have caused a climate event called the Younger Dryas, when the world, which was warming after the end of the last ice age, suddenly returned to glacial conditions. And the trigger of this has been a mystery. This crater raises the possibility that the impact, if it happened 13,000 years ago, could have unleashed this flood into the North Atlantic, which would have shut down a set of currents and triggered the climate shift.
So science's breakthrough of the year in 2016 was the detection of gravitational waves, a messenger from a distant universe. And one of the runners-up from this year is related to that discovery. A new type of messenger, neutrinos, were detected deep in the ice of the South Pole. What are these particles and where did they come from?
So these are very lightweight particles that are really hard to detect. But they've set up this detector, which is basically a cubic kilometer of ice threaded with light detectors. Mm-hmm. It's very clear ice. And so when a neutrino flies through it, it can sometimes trigger a faint flash of light. And from the direction of this flash, they can figure out where the neutrino came from. And this year, they traced one neutrino back to a blazar, which is a kind of very bright galaxy with a black hole at its center. It's the first neutrino to be traced to this kind of source outside our galaxy. And it suggests that these blazars might be the source of other high-energy particles, like the high-energy cosmic rays that sometimes strike the Earth.
So now moving past these runners-up to the breakthrough of the year, which was development cell by cell. And being able to observe cell development wasn't just one discovery necessarily, but a combination of technologies working together. Could you explain what advances are encompassed within this one breakthrough?
So it's really three techniques. First, the ability to extract thousands of cells from a developing embryo. Mm-hmm. Then the ability to sequence their RNA, which tells you what genes are active, cell by cell. You can get basically the genetic activity in each cell. And then there are techniques for tracing cell lineages within embryos. So the RNA sequencing gives you a snapshot of what's going on in an embryo. If you can trace each cell's descendants, you can see where that type of cell, how it contributes to the building of the embryo. So you put it all together and you get this picture in space and time of how each cell kind of assumes its identity and gives rise to new cells to build an embryo.
What organisms and organs development were researchers able to see through these techniques?
Well, they've looked at a bunch of them. The big advance this year was moving these techniques into vertebrates, animals like ourselves, really, zebrafish, salamander limbs, and several others.
Besides tracking development, what were other ways that researchers used single-cell RNA sequencing?
It's revealed things about the development of disease. So you can look at tissues, you can identify the variety of cells that make up those tissues, and you can watch cells change as a disease develops, for example, a cancer.
What do you think we can expect to see in the future as a result of this breakthrough?
Well, I think deeper understanding of the way organisms develop, the way limbs grow, the way diseases develop, and that undoubtedly will lead to medical treatments.
So although we had these breakthroughs of the year, we also had breakdowns. Could you go over what that means?
Well, these are science-related developments that are not good.
Yeah.
That really were steps back. Mm-hmm. We think of science as a march of progress. Well, it isn't always. And so our major breakdown of the year was really the gap between what science is telling us about climate change and the urgency of it, and what policymakers are doing or not doing.
One kind of related advancement that would be the attribution science made gains
That's
this
right.
year, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, we see more clearly than ever that climate change is taking place and that it is getting worse fast and that it is affecting the world we live in very palpable ways. The succession of powerful hurricanes, fires in California, heat waves and far northern latitudes, mm-hmm. all of these can be tied, to greater or lesser extent to climate change.
Were there any other breakdowns included in the list?
Yes. So late in the year, there was the claim that an embryo had been genetically modified and then implanted and brought to term. So babies have been born that have been genetically modified in ways that they will pass on to their children. And this happened without the kind of debate and without the kinds of safeguards that most scientists and ethicists believe are necessary. And without proper, you know, consideration of the health risks to these children.
All right. Thank you so much, Tim.
You're welcome. Pleasure.
That was Tim Appenzeller, news editor of Science. If you want to read more about the breakthrough of 2018, the runners-up, and the breakdowns of the year, visit sciencemag.org/news.
Keep listening for our roundup of the year in books and some suggestions for books that you might want to buy as gifts for the holiday season.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the book segment of the podcast. This is Jen Goldbeck, and we're doing the year in review. I'm here with Valerie Thompson, and we're going to talk about our favorite books and maybe our least favorite books. That'd be easier if we had a couple cocktails, I suppose. things we remembered, and give you some recommendations if you're looking for last-minute holiday gifts.
So, Jen, you interviewed 11 authors for us this year in 2018. One of them I'm thinking of is especially timely here at the end of the year. Do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah. So we did The Perfectionist by Simon Winchester, who is just a wonderful interview, a charming guy who's written a lot of great books. And we had a really long conversation. And I think part of it that didn't make it into his segment on the podcast, you know, this year is the end of the kilogram being defined by that lump of metal that I think is in France. And that's an example of this really precision engineering. And we're getting rid of that and replacing it with a much more accurate and scientific definition. But he talked about how, you know, there's something a little sad in like us as humans not being able to make that reference kilogram anymore. So I thought that that was interesting. I'd forgotten he said that. And then in the news, just, you know, in the last few weeks, we've heard the kilogram is going away and you see this beautiful little kilogram. It's going to be locked into a museum and not worth anything anymore. And that was a nice tie back to his book on, you know, how we can create these very finely milled things and how beautiful human precision can be.
I love that. I love that because it's just this kind of like human story behind this very precise, surreal kind of thing. All right. So can you talk about, did any of the books really draw you in? Was there any that was on a specific topic that you were really intrigued by?
Yeah, we did Clean Meat by Paul Shapiro, which is about lab-grown meat. And I was really excited when you gave me this book because I'm a vegetarian. And, all right. So it was really interesting to look at how's that industry going? It's much farther along than I thought it was. And also talking about what are the ways that we can get people to do this. So, you know, one of the examples he said is that a lot of people are going to be skeezed out eating meat that was grown in a lab. But leather would be a really interesting way to do this. Skin is very easy to grow, relatively, you know, if you're growing it in a lab. There we could replace the leather that we're using that's coming from animals and replace it with something grown in a lab. That's not the end game. You want to replace the whole animal needing to be killed. But it was really interesting because it brought together this kind of commercialization and kind of human component of it in addition to all the other stuff. So I thought it was really interesting. You also have a favorite book this year?
I do have a favorite book. The book that was kind of my favorite book that we reviewed, not on the podcast, but in the magazine, is a book called The Feather Thief: Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century by Kirk Wallace Johnson. The book is centered around a theft that occurred at a natural history museum in the UK in 2009. In the early hours of June 23rd, a man named Edwin Rist broke into the Natural History Museum at Tring and filled a roller suitcase with 299 bird specimens. As the story comes out, we learn that he is a member of an elite community of Victorian fly tyers, flies being the brightly colored lures that people use to catch fish. And his plan was to dismantle these bird specimens and sell the feathers to other fly tying enthusiasts so that he could buy a new flute. Because did I mention that he was a flautist who had earlier that day performed at the London Royal Academy of Music?
This is just gets more insane the more you talk
about it. Yeah, it's like a crazy story. So, you know, he ends up getting caught. And, you know, instead of getting this money for a new flute, he ends up being sentenced to 12 months in prison and he receives a fine.
What happened to the birds?
Well, that's the thing. Like, once these specimens were removed from the museum, and once they were separated from the little tags that are on them that tell you like what the specimen is and when it was collected and by whom, they don't have any more scientific value. So even the specimens that were recovered, those lose their value. A lot of them were dismantled. Just the agony of like what has been lost to science. And so it's a really interesting, I think I'm like kind of like a true crime person too. So this is why that story really resonates with me, I think.
That sounds fantastic. So, recommendations, woman with the shelves and shelves full of books.
Okay, I'm going to recommend Philip Moriarty's When the Uncertainty Principle Goes to 11, or How to Explain Quantum Physics with Heavy Metal. It's a great premise. The idea is that music is an ideal platform for introducing concepts like the physics of waves and harmonics and resonance and energy conservation. And so he kind of like does these cute analogies where he shows how physics' famous double slit experiment and Eddie Van Halen's Brown Sound both share this key feature, which is waveform interference. He looks at the statistical mechanisms of crowds in a mosh pit. He compares the sound of the Big Bang with the loudest heavy metal concert. So very fun. Physics is not my strong suit, so I'm always kind of on the hunt for things that can lead me to it slowly, I guess. So I thought this book was really fun. For the politically minded in the audience, I'm going to recommend Liliana Mason's Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity. So this is like a very kind of relevant one for our time. So it looks at how political polarization became such a prominent feature of our political system. She kind of argues that there's become more and more overlap between our other identities, so a person's race, their religious affiliation, whether they think of themselves as liberal, conservative, and then like whether we consider ourselves to be a Democrat or a Republican. And so when we start identifying psychologically with a particular party, we start to experience this animosity towards the other team and a desire for our own team to win, which kind of becomes an end unto itself, even if we don't have particularly strong feelings for the issue. So it's a really interesting look at this thing that we're all kind of wondering about. And she does have some ideas for how we might try to mitigate those.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I hope that works.
Yeah, I hope so too. I hope somebody takes them to heart. So you had a recommendation for a gift this year too.
So I love to do combination gifts. And I think we talked about that when we did our year in the review last year, where I think we had a wine book and I'm like, oh, it'd be great. You give a bottle of wine and then this book. So this year, I recommend you get a bottle of Lysol disinfectant. And then this book, Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live by Rob Dunn. This is a book that I got sent from the publisher. I just looked it up on Amazon today. It's the number one bestseller in ichthyology on Amazon, which is a pretty cool distinction. But it's sort of about how we like aspire to have these super clean, pristine homes and how they're totally not. And there's all of these bugs and organisms and stuff living in there with us. One of my favorite examples from it that it, I think, opens with towards the beginning is talking about this research lab where they're looking at these organisms that live in like thermal vents, these super high temperatures, and how we'd never really been able to find them before because our regular lab temperatures are so cold, even our hot lab temperatures are so cold that they couldn't live. And then you'd put them at these hot temperatures and, oh, they were there. And then we started learning about them. And in the lab, they're like, maybe these are actually all over the place and not just in these thermal vents, and started looking at like their coffee pot, which didn't have any, but other places where there's hot water, and they found them there. So there actually are these what seem like really exotic organisms, like, oh, they're in these thermal vents, but actually they live in all these crazy environments that we create in these small places around where we live, and talks about how our weird household obsessions actually can kind of drive evolution in some of these microorganisms. But yeah, I think that'd make a nice gift with some Raid or some Lysol, which it just is a nice little
I don't know. Is that like embracing or rejecting like the premise of the book? This is Jen's last episode as our host. She's been hosting this segment for us for the last 2 years. So I just want to say thank you on behalf of all of us at Science. It's been great to work with you. I've loved listening to your interviews. You've done a great job and we're really going to miss you.
I've had a super fun time. I love that I now have a couple shelves of books that I've reviewed for Science. And as a fiction reader by choice, it has been a really great opportunity to find like the best new science books that are out there. And then also get to have my own personal conversations with the people who are writing them. So I've had a great time.
Great. I'm glad we converted you.
Yeah, he did. I'm now reading all sorts of new ones.
All right, great.
Thanks, everyone. Have a very Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah and Happy New Year and Happy Holidays and all those things. And someone else will be back with you in the new year with more books.
Just a reminder that this episode has been brought to you in part by Atlassian's OpsGenie. Incidents happen. Thankfully, OpsGenie empowers dev and ops teams to plan for service disruptions and stay in control during incidents. It also gives teams the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues and helps to notify all the right people through a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths. With OpsGenie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. Visit OpsGenie.com to sign up to get a free company account and add up to 5 team members. That's OpsGenie.com, OpsGenie.com. Never miss a critical alert again with OpsGenie. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts, or you can listen on the Science website. That's sciencemag.org/podcast. To place an ad on the podcast, contact midroll.com. The show was produced by Sarah Crespi and Megan Cantwell and edited by Podigy. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started.